News. From Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly half-hour review of New York State government and politics. Your host is political scientist and syndicated columnist Dr. Alan Shartok of the State University.
In this edition of the Legislative Gazette, we'll talk with an assemblyman with a mission. We'll also update some recent legislative developments. Perhaps you're retired, or your parents are retired, or a neighbor has reached what are called the golden years. If you know someone in that position, a senior citizen, then perhaps you're aware that many seniors living on fixed incomes face mounting bills for prescription medication. It's a serious problem, and one the New York legislature is trying to address. But, as we hear in this report from Rick Lepkowski, one which may not get settled this year.
Providing state aid to senior citizens for prescription drugs has been a topic discussed in Albany for at least the past 10 years. But the Senate and Assembly could never come to terms on an aid package. This year, the governor has presented a bill. The Assembly has passed their version of the measure. And this past week, the Senate passed a $60 million aid package put forth by Senator Hugh Farley of Schenectady. Under the Farley bill, those seniors who spend 5% or more of their incomes on prescription drugs would be reimbursed by the state for any money spent on prescription drugs above that 5%.
It's a little bit of a different approach with my bill in that there's a threshold that must be reached of spending 5% of their income, and we'll help them thereafter. The point now is that we will enter into negotiations with the governor's office and with the Assembly to try to come up with some sort of an agreement on an agreed-upon bill.
So can we expect something this session before...
It very possibly could be this session. I suspect in all reality it will be something that is effective in 1986. It could be early next session, something that would take place perhaps, let's say, in April of 1986. Or my bill is theoretically is effective January 86, which would have impact on this budget. But I think we're talking next year's budget.
Governor Cuomo's prescription drug proposal is similar somewhat to Senator Farley's in the fact that it takes a so-called catastrophic approach to providing aid, or providing aid to only those elderly who incur substantial drug expenses. But the bill introduced and passed in the Assembly is much broader, much more expensive, and would provide aid to many more senior citizens. Assemblyman Paul Herrenberg of Long Island.
My bill is the only one of the three you mentioned that is endorsed by every senior organization in the whole state. So clearly they have looked at all three bills very carefully, and they've come to the conclusion that my bill will affect many more people. It will affect three times as many people as Senator Farley's bill will, for example. And I don't know how many more.
Would be left out under Senator Farley?
Senator Farley's bill, almost all seniors would be left out. The only ones who would get it are those who are in catastrophic condition. That is, those who spend more than 5% of their income on medicines would be covered. Anybody else would not be covered at all.
And that's similar to the governor's also.
Yes, the governor's is also
catastrophic approach.
Yeah. The Assembly has taken the position that there are many other people who may not be in a catastrophic condition where they don't spend 5% of their income on medicines, but they nevertheless are of such low income that even a few prescriptions a year is hurting them because of the high cost of medicines, which have increased some 143% during the last 10 years, while seniors' incomes have not increased anywhere near that. And we want to help more than just those who are in catastrophic situations.
Both the Herrenberg bill and the governor's bill contain a provision urging physicians to prescribe more generic drugs to senior citizens rather than the more costly brand names. Under the Herrenberg plan, this would be done by changing the prescription form from a two-line to a one-line form. Currently, a physician will fill in the brand name drug on a line that says either dispense as written or a line that says substitution is permissible. With the one-line form, it's assumed the substitution would be permissible unless the physician writes out after his or her signature, dispense as written. Assemblyman Herrenberg says he hopes this will prompt physicians and pharmacists to use the less costly generic drugs.
One of the problems in our state is that most doctors still prescribe by brand name because we have a form in which it makes it convenient to either sign on one or the other side, and a lot of doctors are in the habit of doing a brand name prescription and signing it on the side where the senior is left no choice but to pay for the very expensive brand name. Some of those brand names are seven times as expensive as the generic, and they're manufactured, generics I mentioned, manufactured in most cases by the same company that's making the brand name. We think a lot of senior citizens' money is being wasted on pharmaceuticals that are more expensive than they need to be for the elderly. And since the state can't afford to provide a program which will pay for the most expensive brand names for everybody who needs this, we are going to pay for brand names only where there is no generic medicine available. But we're going to say to the doctors, we're changing the prescription pad to try to encourage you to do more prescribing of generic medicines so that the seniors will not have to pay the difference between the generic and the brand name price, which they would otherwise have to pay if a brand name is prescribed. The estimates by the Ways and Means Committee of the savings to seniors of just that portion of the bill, just the generic portion of it, is $270 million that is now being spent by seniors on brand name drugs that would not be spent if we switched to generic. Now, I would caution you to remind you that we still are leaving the doctor the option of prescribing by brand name if a particular elderly person perhaps has been using a certain brand and is used to it and he feels that a change to a different brand, to a generic brand, might not do them good. He can still do that. And he does that simply by writing the brand name and putting a DAW under it, dispense as written, which means he wants that prescription filled exactly by the brand that he put it for. However, the elderly person is going to have to pay the difference between the generic and the brand name.
It has been the Herrenberg bill that has received the support from senior citizens advocates in New York State. It's much more expensive, calling for $140 million in spending compared to Senator Farley's $60 million and the governor's $28 million. But it would also provide aid to an estimated three times as many senior citizens. Jane Murgo of the New York State Coalition of the Concerned for Older Americans.
One problem we have with the governor's bill is that, let's take an unmarried individual. To be eligible for the program, a person whose income was $5,200, for instance, they would have to spend $450 on drugs before they could get any help whatsoever. If you subtract $450 from $5,200, you're almost down to $4,600, $4,700, which is Medicaid eligibility level. They really reduce you almost to poverty before your person with $5,200 a year income is poor to begin with, but they make you spend a tremendous proportion of your limited income to qualify for a program. Besides having to spend $450 on drugs, and of course, if this all has to be documented, which is not easy, the governor's bill also requires a $25 annual registration fee plus a $4 copayment. So it's not too generous at all. It certainly does not show that the governor is providing the kind of help that was indicated by his promise for a prescription drug for the elderly. I think he fell a little short.
Assemblyman Herrenberg says providing aid to senior citizens for prescription drugs is an issue whose time has come, and he predicts the Senate, Assembly, and the governor can come to terms on an aid package. Those thoughts have also been echoed by Senator Farley and Governor Cuomo. But the proposals put forth thus far are quite different in numbers and on how to distribute the aid. And even after a plan is agreed upon, it will take at least a few years to iron out the wrinkles. In New Jersey, for example, the state which first implemented a prescription aid program in 1975, the program has been changed almost every year in efforts to contain costs and provide adequate service. In Albany, I'm Rick Lepkowski.
When you say New York to out-of-staters, many automatically think of New York City. Others remember Niagara Falls or the Finger Lakes or the beaches of Long Island. But for many, especially those who tuned in to the 1980 Olympics, New York is the Adirondacks. This week, that celebrated section of our state marked an important anniversary. Bill Gralty reports.
Until I became a public official, I didn't have the opportunity to travel around the state. Now, obviously, I had the same sensitivity to natural beauties that most people have growing up in any environment. But I didn't know the Adirondacks well. I didn't know the North Country well. I didn't know that the Adirondacks were the oldest mountains on the continent.
It took Governor Mario Cuomo quite a few years to discover the Adirondacks. 100 years ago this week, Governor David Hill signed legislation creating the New York Forest Preserve, land in the Adirondacks and Catskills, set aside to be, in words often cited during environmental battles, forever wild. Governor Hill and legislative leaders of his day acted out of concern that lumber interests were in danger of denuding the vast woods. The bill stopped that and saved the Adirondacks until the automobile opened the wilderness to the average New Yorker. But there lies one of the major problems facing the Adirondacks today. George Davis is program director of the Adirondack Council.
Well, the popularity of the Forest Preserve does cause a few problems, but they're problems that I guess in retrospect, as we look at what the other options would be, we probably should be very pleased that we have these kinds of problems. The main problems are resulting from people loving the Forest Preserve to death. The biggest problem that I can think of in the Forest Preserve is the overuse in the High Peaks region south of Lake Placid. And in this region, we have trails that are 10, 15, 20 feet wide and real quagmires because of so many people climbing Mount Marcy and the other mountains there.
So what's the solution? Tell people they can't climb Mount Marcy? No, but...
You can say that there will be no more than X number that can climb it in any one day. This has been done in areas in New Hampshire. It's done in a lot of the wilderness areas, designated wilderness areas in the state of California, and in a few areas elsewhere in the nation. But I think New Hampshire and California are the outstanding ones, where you have to determine the carrying capacity of the resource. How many people can use the resource without destroying that very resource they're using?
In addition to minimizing the damage done by people seeking the wilderness experience, Davis says they want to enlarge the area under state protection.
We've been pushing very, very hard for more Forest Preserve acquisitions, and particularly ones that would expand the wilderness resource of the Forest Preserve. We have 1 million-plus acres designated as wilderness now out of the 2.5 million acres of Forest Preserve up here. But if we can expand that, I think we will be able to say there will always be room.
Governor Cuomo says his administration is working to acquire more land, is providing more money for the Adirondack Park Council, and in general wants to carry on the stewardship that began with Governor Hill and continued through each succeeding governor.
Now I'm the governor, and now it's my moral and legal obligation to protect the Adirondacks, but I feel a growing reverence for our natural beauty. I see it as a moral issue, if anything can be a moral issue, and you know I'm reluctant to use the language. The reason you think of the Adirondacks and the Forest Preserves and the environment generally as a moral issue is that you are preserving something for the next generation.
In Albany, I'm Bill Gralty.
Now let's hear from Professor Gerald Benjamin. Jerry is a political scientist and a Republican county legislator in Ulster County. He joins us from time to time with observations on state issues.
On September 10, 1983, two men in their 20s hanged themselves in local jails in the Utica area. John P. Campbell was an honor student at the SUNY College of Technology. A first offender, he had been arrested on a DWI charge by city police earlier that morning. Bruce Murray, a repeat offender, was serving a 9-month term in the Oneida County Jail for assault and harassment. Campbell and Murray were two of 17 suicides in upstate New York jails and lockups in 1983. In 1984, the number increased by more than a third to 24. In fact, in New York and across the nation, the rate of suicide in local detention facilities is higher than in state and federal prisons, and dramatically higher than in the population as a whole. There are many reasons for this, but one major one is the increased number of mentally ill persons and drug and alcohol abusers being committed to local prison facilities. Could John Campbell's suicide have been prevented? What of Bruce Murray's? In 1984, the New York State Office of Mental Hygiene and the Commission on Corrections developed a local forensic suicide prevention project in order to find out. The program's objective was to begin to forge links between local mental health and criminal justice agencies in New York. Its premise? Jail suicide would be dramatically reduced if local prison officers could be trained to spot potentially suicidal prisoners early and then make referrals so that there was timely access to appropriate mental health services. The project was conceived in two stages and designed so as to require state and local cooperation. At the state level, in phase one, an advisory committee comprised of representatives of 6 criminal justice and mental hygiene agencies oversaw the development of a crisis model by the OMH Bureau of Evaluation Research. This model outlined the service responsibilities of criminal justice and mental health administrative in-line personnel at the local level. It was to serve as a guide for the development of specific programs and activities. Simultaneously, after a statewide competition, the Ulster County Community Mental Health Services Agency was selected as the local organization that was to develop prisoner screening guidelines and training materials for jail and lockup personnel. Since most suicides in local jails occurred during the first day of imprisonment, careful screening was seen as a key to success in suicide prevention. Research revealed several demographic and behavioral factors associated with jail lockup suicide. High-risk persons included males, younger prisoners, first offenders, those in the influence of alcohol or drugs when arrested, persons who had previously been treated for mental illness, and those who had made other suicide attempts. Other cues included overt expressions of shame at having been arrested, evidence of a recent and significant personal loss, and the absence of close family or other persons to whom to turn in times of crisis. These factors were then incorporated in a set of guidelines to be used at the time of prisoner booking by local criminal justice staff and then tested for a month in the Ulster County Jail and the Ellenville Police Lockup. Tests proved the form usable by corrections officers and police without disrupting established routines and was successful in eliciting the necessary information from prisoners. Further testing of the guidelines and training materials, Phase 2, is now underway in 6 additional upstate counties. Should evaluation prove these tests successful, major changes in both state and local procedures for local jails and lockups will surely follow. And these will not have to be imposed by the state, for sheriffs and police chiefs know that, more than ever before, courts are holding them liable for the well-being of inmates, including protection against suicide. If the guidelines were in place in 1983, would John Campbell's suicide or Bruce Murray's have been prevented? There's no way of knowing. So given the guidelines, a trained sheriff's deputy may have kept Campbell, at least, under an especially watchful eye or immediately sought assistance from the county mental health agency. All jail suicide cannot be prevented, but if one John Campbell is saved by this program this year or in subsequent years, New York State's $180,000 two-year investment in it will have been well spent.
For many, the image of politics is that of the smoke-filled room, that place of mystery and tobacco, where deals were cut and decisions were made. Of course, recent changes in the system have let considerable fresh air into the political process. For some lawmakers, that's enough, but not for Assemblyman Alexander Pete Granis, who is without doubt the legislature's leading campaigner against smoking.
Well, I think I've been listening to the public health warnings about this issue for a number of years, and I believe very strongly that people who exist in our society have the right to function, at least in public places, in an environment that doesn't have other people smoke in it. I think that's not necessarily a constitutional right, but certainly it's a moral right, and it's when it's balanced off against somebody's habit, where the habit involves smoke, which people say is a threat to other people's health and safety and well-being and certainly to their comfort. I think the asking for a small sacrifice on the part of the smoker to benefit the majority of the people that don't smoke is not a great big change in how we live our lives.
How would you do it? I mean, what would the legislation look like?
Our bill is patterned after a number of other states' legislation, which would say that the norm would be no smoking in all of these public places that we're talking about, including offices and restaurants and a number of other places, unless it was specifically permitted by the proprietor. It would leave it up to the proprietor to make the decisions on how and where smoking would be permitted. It would not have any very tight standards on how that decision could be made, but it would require him to take affirmative action to permit smoking. And recognizing, again, that most of the people in our society don't smoke, I think that that's a fairly non-intrusive way to go about this issue.
Of course, we always talk about the rights of the minority versus the rights of the majority. Isn't smoking a minority right?
It's not a question of a right. We're not dealing with a right here. We're not dealing with whether you can smoke. We're dealing with where you can smoke. And there's very strong public sentiment for limiting where you can smoke. I don't think we could make it with a law that said you couldn't smoke at all. But I think that there's an acceptance, both by smokers and certainly by non-smokers, that a reasonable limitation on where you can smoke, as long as it's not too broad-based, is something that is workable and accommodates the rights of the people that want to go on smoking. It just says that they can't do it everywhere.
Now, Assemblyman Seminario, who is one of your adversaries on this question, friendly I may add, often says that how is he going to enforce it? So how are you going to enforce this? Recently, I was in a restaurant, Pete. On the menu, it said, no smoking in the dining room. In come two fat cats. They sit down. They proceed to smoke till I'm almost choking. So then the next question is, did the guy come in and say you can't smoke here and kick out $100 worth of business? He did not. How would you make sure it gets enforced?
I think the enforcement is one of the issues that's been raised by the opponents of the legislation we've been considering. I think it's really a red herring in this. And the enforcement would be mainly self-enforcing. Given the widespread public support for this kind of bill and the general inclination of people to abide by reasonable laws, the fact that we're a law-abiding society, I think that the bill could be self-enforcing. To the greater degree. I mean, we have laws now on the books that people don't abide by. You were choked because of no smoking in a restaurant. People speed regularly. But most people don't. Most people abide by reasonable laws, and I think that that would be the greatest incentive. On top of that, I think for the cases, there would be some monitoring of this, but I don't see any action by police coming into a restaurant to enforce that. I think what our law would do would be to put you within your rights under the law to go over to an individual and say, look, I don't believe there's any smoking here. And I, you know, that won't always be the case. That won't always work. But I think 9 times out of 10, that may make the difference.
Pete, you are a man with a passion on this thing. You're the chairman of the important housing committee in the assembly. But this is an issue that you come by clearly because you're committed to it. Can one person, one legislator who really feels deeply about an issue make a change?
Well, I'm not alone in my fight. I've got a number of allies, starting with the U.S. Surgeon General, who thinks this is an incredibly important issue, not in New York State, but nationally. Our own health commissioner, the governor of the state, Mario Cuomo, put in a program bill that was stronger than mine. A number of my colleagues feel very strongly about it. Even in the Senate, where the bill can't get to the floor because it can't get through the Health Committee chairman.
Why not? Why doesn't he want it out?
Well, I don't think he has told us he doesn't like the approach, the basic standard of no smoking that would have to be undone. He wants a different approach. We've had difficulty in trying to accommodate his interest in the issue because it wouldn't provide for a uniform standard throughout the state. But we've been constantly trying to find an accommodation with the Senate Health Committee chairman on this issue, and if we can, I believe we can reach an agreement that would put New York really in the vanguard of trying to deal with this issue in a reasonable way.
Do you see smoking as a Democratic or Republican issue?
Well, there's nothing partisan about what's going on. 12,000 people die each year in New York from lung cancer that is not enrollment-specific. Those are people across the board. It is a problem of very great importance to people that have heart conditions and asthma without regard to where their registration may lie, and it's not an issue that is... I have very strong Republican support for the bill. It is member-specific and not a party issue.
Do you see this as one of those issues like seatbelts, drinking age, which essentially curtails people's freedom to do something that in the long run might be harmful to themselves? And we hear a lot of rhetoric over this. This is very divisive in the society, whether or not we are pulling people away from their basic freedom of choice.
No, I don't see this as that kind of an issue. And this basically says if you want to go on smoking, do it. But just don't do it in a way that impinges on the health, safety, or comfort of somebody else. If you want to go outside and smoke, if you want to go out in the corridor and smoke, that's fine. Interestingly enough, if you ever looked at the basic tenets of the different parties, the Conservative Party ought to be the most vehement in support of this kind of a measure because they're constantly saying, don't do things that infringe on my freedom. When we have a small percentage of the population that smokes, and for a number of people, according to our polls, that smoke bothers them. So why should they be able to do something that bothers me when they can go off and do it somewhere else that doesn't bother me? And that's the basic issue. Their right to smoke stops when I have to breathe that smoke when I'm in a restaurant or in an elevator or a train or a plane or waiting in line at a bank.
Last question. Try it on you one more time. There is always a psychological reason that somebody takes on a fight of this kind. What is it with you?
Well, I think two things. The merits of the issue, I think, are very compelling. I think the pig-headedness, if you will, of the industry and the protectiveness, if you look at what the issues are that we're working on as opposed to the issues that they're protecting, the cigarette interests the companies are protecting, they want to go on making this product, and their interest is in money. My interest is in the public health, and they have pulled out the stops in lobbying both ethically and, I believe, many times unethically to try and block this legislation here. And I think, if anything, that has increased my ardor for trying to get it through.
There's really no personal reason. Nobody in your immediate family or anybody has died from this, for example.
No personal reason, and I'm not the zealot of a reform smoker or anything like that. I think the issue is important. And I think if you watch what's happening across the country, an awful lot of people realize it's important as many, many localities and other states and counties in this state and local governments are moving ahead with adopting their own versions of anti-smoking regulations.
Assemblyman Pete Granis.
Smoking. If there's a societal evil, it's smoking. Along with obesity, it's a major problem for this civilization. It's a problem because smoke destroys our lungs, gives us cancer and emphysema, and leads to heart and circulation problems. But despite all of that, millions of Americans continue to smoke. The basic idea is, quote, it's my life and you can't tell me what to do with my life. Along comes Assemblyman Alexander Pete Grannis and says, "Oh, yes, I can." Grannis doesn't have the nerve to say that state has a right to stop someone from smoking outright, even though he knows that smoking kills. Even Grannis knows that prohibitions don't work. But Grannis reasons that non-smokers have rights, too. They have a right to breathe non-polluted air, and the state has a right to demand that restaurants, like airlines, have specific sections for smokers to pollute each other. A fairly easy concept. But there are a few problems. The first of these is, who polices the smoking law if it indeed becomes law? Can you just imagine a party of six coming in to spend several hundred dollars in a restaurant? The maitre d' inquires whether the party wants the smoking or non-smoking section. Let's say five out of six are non-smokers, so they're seated in the non-smoking section. But the compulsive smoker in the group, who also just happens to be the boss of the corporation paying the bill, lights up right in the middle of the meal. Now, who's going to be the hero who says, "No, you can't do that"? Is it going to be the non-smokers who work for this polluter, who are going to tell him to extinguish the butt? Is it going to be the tip-seeking maitre d', the captain or the waiter who tells him? Is it going to be a beleaguered New York City policeman who can't begin to deal with major felonies, who's going to see smoke through the front window and come running in and yelling, "Put out that cigarette"? No, the answer is that if it is anyone, it will be the lady or gentleman at the next table who will call over to the waiter and complain. So the answer is, and this was almost admitted by Grannis in the interview, the answer is that no one will enforce the law, but that many people will obey it just because it is the law, just like seatbelts and the 21-year-old purchase age. But what I love about the legislature and the legislative process is that it takes a Pete Grannis, one committed legislator with a bee in his bonnet, to do the right thing and try to pass such a law because Pete Grannis, the human being, thinks it should be done. But on the other side of that is that the legislation is not moving anywhere because Grannis says that Tarky Lombardi, the Republican chairman of the Senate Health Committee, doesn't like the direction the bill takes. And so it goes. The wisdom of the legislature embodied in a young legislator trying to make a change and the Republican senator who says, prove it to us that your bill is a good idea. That's what makes for good legislation. That's the test. When the case is made, the bill will become law. As for me, I think Grannis is right. Smoking is bad, bad, bad. You know it, I know it, and the smokers know it. I'll be away next week. I'm going to Japan. So you'll be left in the capable hands of Bill Gralty. That's our show for this week. The Gazette will be back again with another look at state government and politics. Bill Gralty edits and produces this program. Rick Lipkowski is associate editor. Please address comments and questions to us at WAMC, Box 13000, Albany, New York, 12212. I'm Alan Chartok.
The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC News. Alan Chartok is executive producer. This program is made possible with funds provided by the State University of New York College at New Paltz.